Thank you for tuning back in to your DenverBroncos.com podcast. Obviously, we're coming off the heels of a very disappointing loss, one that's still tender for most fans and players alike, I'm sure. And as much as we'd like to kind of get past it, we do have to do a little post-mortem on it. Broncos losing at home 24-13 to the Colts. Obviously, this was a rematch of the Week 1 matchup. Beating those teams that you faced before that aren't in division is always tough. The Broncos have been able to get past the division rematches, but this one was not as easy.
Well, you talk about how it's kind of a post-mortem, and there's almost a pall over the Broncos and Broncos fans. You know, you talk about the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
What are we at?
Well, it's interesting because I think at first I thought people were going to linger on anger, and then the events of the days that followed, which we're going to get into in more detail later on the podcast, you know, as far as, you know, parting ways with John Fox and moving quickly into a search, I think really put most Broncos fans at acceptance, I think, pretty fast. So it hasn't, because of what's happened, I don't think it's going to linger with fans as much as, you know, the Super Bowl did or the Baltimore lost it a couple of years ago, because there have already been some decisive reactions to it internally. Certainly when John Elway spoke on Tuesday, he talked about how he wants his team to go down, quote, kicking and screaming, unquote. He talked about how he didn't really feel like he saw the fire from his team on the field on Sunday afternoon, while at the same time saying, hey, the fans brought it. The fans had the energy. The fans had the passion. But, you know, I think because of the things that happened, they've, you know, I hate to say it, kind of moved past it, but really it seems like, you know, they very quickly moved on to the next thing, even though I think when we get to the OTAs and we get the players back in the building on a day-to-day basis, I think there's going to be questions about that game and how you prevent another loss like that, another loss in which not only your season ends by being beaten, but beaten thoroughly and really kind of capitulating when another team brought pressure on you.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say, you know, Broncos fans seem to have accepted it, especially because of what's happened a couple of days. And I would agree with you. I think people feel like, yeah, that happened. That wasn't unreasonable. It wasn't, shocking or devastating as a couple of losses in the past. I think the biggest frustration with fans now is that it's one more year that Peyton Manning doesn't win the Super Bowl as his career winds down. So the time, you know, is ticking there.
Yeah, and we don't know how long that clock has left. I mean, that's going to be the something we certainly touch on in the next few weeks. Just what will Peyton Manning do? John Elway has said it's going to give him 4 or 5 weeks to decide on whether he's going to come back for a fourth Broncos season, for an 18th NFL season, or retire. You know, the key thing there is he has to have his decision made by the start of the league year on March 9th, because that's when his if he's on the roster, then his salary for 2015 becomes guaranteed. So that's what's driving the timeline, although Elway's saying 4 or 5 weeks. Also dovetails with the scouting combine. I think even if there's not an announcement externally about Peyton Manning's future by that point, I think Elway wants to know what he's looking at and what he's dealing with before he goes to watch every quarterback prospect in the draft in Indianapolis.
And Manning's play was certainly something of a focus on Sunday. One of his worst performances in the postseason that we've seen throughout his career, 26 of 46 for 211 yards. And you look at that game, you look at that first drive, and you kind of thought things were going in their favor, and it just kind of shifted entirely. I think the key kind of turning point there was probably the fumble coming around from around the left tackle.
Yeah, that was a key turning point. And even those statistics that he put up, a lot of them, that was padded by that last drive at the end when the Colts just dropped everybody and conceded everything underneath. First drive was promising. You know, he hit Julius Thomas was, it was coming out on the little wheel type route on Ron Landry, got some separation up the left side. You know, place was going crazy. You looked at that drive and you thought, this team's got it today. But Yeah.
And they had earned the mismatches that they wanted on that drive, which you'd like to see schematically.
Oh, yeah.
Landry on Demaryius Thomas for the touchdown. Mm-hmm. Landry on Julius Thomas. They'll take that every day.
Yeah. But then what happened? You speak of the you speak of the strip sack fumble in the second quarter. That's huge. But at the deep pass after that was no longer there, and the Colts were, you know, giving the Broncos some opportunities on goes and Hitchin goes up the sideline as the second quarter progressed, especially, and Manning wasn't able to get the ball there, was misfiring, and at that point when you abandon that part of the game, all of a sudden then it's giving your linebackers and safeties license to stay down, stay underneath, and really make life miserable for your underneath targets. It's a big part of why, until that last drive, the Broncos only averaged 2.4 yards after the catch per reception. During the season, that figure was 5.1, because you had to, you know, give a lot of credit also to the corners that were doing a good job, you know, being aggressive at the snap, being aggressive at the line of scrimmage, but also, you know, a lot of it was out of the Seahawks playbook from Super Bowl 48. And Vontae Davis even touched on this to the Indianapolis Star, saying they watched Seahawks tape and just tried to do exactly what they did.
Yeah, he wasn't shy about saying that was the blueprint for this game, for this defensive game plan. And really, they stayed in man coverage the entire time. Broncos players said it afterwards. They said they didn't do anything that wasn't expected. They just played man, and they really, really emphasized biting on the short routes, covering the inside routes, forcing Manning to go further to the outside, deeper down the field, make the longer throws. And we know that he was bothered by a leg injury. We wonder, the roughing the passer call on that first drive, you wonder if that hit low below his legs, if that affected him at all. But clearly he wasn't able to go deep and connect on the throws that the Colts were willing to give him.
And then you look on the defensive side of the ball, the pass rush got a little bit there on the first couple drives, and then it kind of evaporated. Andrew Luck had plenty of time to make his reads, and they couldn't, even when he turned the ball over, the Broncos offense couldn't turn those turnovers from the defense into anything.
And those turnovers were basically punts. Mm-hmm. They were deep passes, net change of field position, 37 and 39 yards, which was right in line with Pat McAfee's net average of 37.5. So, you know, I actually, even the way I wrote about it after the game was, technically the Broncos won the turnover battle, but practically the Colts did, because the Broncos, A, they were like punts, and B, the Broncos only turned those, you know, turnovers into field goals and didn't get a touchdown out of them, whereas the Colts managed to take their fumble recovery and turn it into 7 points. So just, you know, missed opportunities all around. You talk about the defense. They blitz, you know, we know that this isn't really a blitzing defense. Blitzed 8 times, but even when they blitzed, really didn't do anything to rattle Andrew Luck. You know, it was usually Daniel Heron, when he was in the backfield, did a nice job of picking up guys in pass pro. Luck, aside from that first series, looked very comfortable back there, and that's poison. If a guy that good is that settled in the pocket, then it's going to be a long day for you.
Yeah, to me there was one play that really stood out as far as the Broncos defense versus the Colts offense, and it was, I think, the second play of what turned out to be an 8-minute drive for the Colts in the fourth quarter that really wound the clock, kicked a field goal to move it to 2 possessions. DeMarcus Ware ripped off the left tackle's edge, got around him, swiped at the ball as Andrew Luck was bringing the ball back to throw, and just missed the ball. I mean, we have a photo from one of our team photographers.
It was like the St. Louis game. Remember when the ball actually came out of Sean Hill's hands, but it went right to him, and that could have changed the entire complexion of that fourth quarter.
And we have this photo. You can't see how he missed the football. It's so close. And a strip sack there, I believe it was an 8-point game at that point.
Yes.
And maybe things change a little bit. And Von Miller arrived just late on the same play. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's about a 15-yard completion to T.Y. Hilton in the middle of the field. And they really ground the clock on that drive. They went 8-14, 13 plays, 54 yards, and the field goal, which left the Broncos with about 4 minutes to make up 11 points.
And that might have been, although there were 3 touchdown drives, that was probably the most disappointing moment for the defense. I mean, it's battled some injuries, sure, but still the number one defense in the AFC and yards per game, yards per play going into the playoffs, and to have that kind of drive on you when the season was on the line.
And a lot of it came on the ground.
Yeah, I think certainly that's, you know, that may be part of what John Elway was talking about with his now famous kicking and screaming comment.
You talk about a missed opportunity. Not only does that kind of nail down this game, but it also seems like that kind of sums up the season as they fall in their first game of the postseason, and probably was one of the reasons that we'll talk about real shortly is why the team and head coach John Fox decided to separate.
You know, there were obviously the stuff with Fox also, you know, involved some of the pregame reports. I mean, I remember being on the field before the game and seeing the tweets and hearing about the news that that Jay Glazer reported on Fox Sports about Fox thinking that he might be fired if they lose and that he'd be a top candidate for other jobs. You know, that certainly did not help matters, but I think in retrospect the wheels were in motion. Even a team CEO, Joe Ellis, told the Denver Post that, you know, the writing was on the wall and he saw it.
So I'll just go ahead and make this audible. We'll just talk about this now. But now that we've heard Elway speak at the press conference about what he's looking for in a head coach, what do you think the Broncos need in a head coach to kind of make that next step to not only get back to the Super Bowl, but to win one?
Well, he talked about, like he said, you know, wanting the team to play with fire. That doesn't necessarily mean that the coach himself is fiery. It's getting that out of his players. That's the key. That's the key thing. I think people confuse fire and intensity in a coach with having that for the entire team. Sometimes it doesn't always translate, and sometimes, you know, there are coaches who are quieter that do get that. You know, that do kind of get that fire from their team. So, you know, you look at some of the reported candidates that have been tossed about in the media. You know, you look at Gary Kubiak, who's been around the Broncos staff as an assistant coach, and he also has the championship pedigree that Elway spoke of, being on the staffs of both the Broncos and the 49ers in 1994 when they won Super Bowls. But it was interesting. I was talking with Jeb Putzier, former tight end for the Broncos, last night, doing a radio spot on our partner at KOA, and Jeb was saying that, you know, even though Kubiak has, you know, kind of a personality that on the surface seems very even-keeled, that he did a great job getting the offense fired up. Jeb actually played for him in Houston as well and said that really he did a great job of, like, motivating the entire team and having them play with that fire, which I think kind of illustrates that just because you see a coach who's really active and tenacious, and Fox did say, or pardon me, Elway did say that John Fox was tenacious and didn't lose that, but for some reason, in that playoff game, it didn't seem to translate, and, you know, it didn't translate last year in the Super Bowl as well. So it might be about finding that coach who isn't necessarily a yeller and a screamer, but can certainly bring out some of that of belching fire and farting smoke in his players.
Now, when you say you talk about the championship pedigree, is that how important is that? Because someone's got to win their first Super Bowl. You don't just you know, appear and magically become like a Super Bowl champion as a head coach.
Right.
Well, but I'm not certain that he means necessarily as a head coach.
Right.
I think the number of head coaches out there have won Super Bowls who are available and willing to coach moving forward is pretty small.
Yeah, the willingness to coach, because it was funny that Tony Dungy, I think he tweeted very quickly, "I'm not coming back to coaching," because
right.
With the Peyton Manning connection, it seemed like a lot of people put that together, but he's
right.
not coming back.
And people who hope for Bill Cowher, he's pretty settled in. We know John Gruden is, you know, just re-upped with ESPN for mm-hmm. long term. So I think those are sort of outlandish a little bit.
And then you're left with Dick Vermeil, who's 70, a very spry, very active 78, but still 78 years old at
sure.
this point.
Yeah, and so I guess I would go back to your point about Kubiak and being on a staff that has won a Super Bowl or multiple Super Bowls and sees that mentality day in and day out.
And certainly if you look at some at the template for a lot of recent Super Bowl winning coaches, Bill Belichick, Tom Coughlin, you know, both those guys had before they got to their current stops had Super Bowl experience as assistants, both with the Giants, and also had been head coach somewhere else. And I think so. You really kind of you delve into the resumes of the potential candidates. What's in their background? The first looks like the first guy up is going to be Terrell Austin, the defensive coordinator from Detroit, who's reportedly going to come in for an interview. Now, he doesn't have a Super Bowl winning pedigree, but he has been on a Super Bowl staff with the Arizona Cardinals a few years ago.
And well, he was actually on the 2012 Ravens as the secondary coach.
That's right.
Okay,
there you go. Yeah. So he knows how to do it. He's seen how to do it, I should say.
Sure. He's been around it, and he comes specifically Baltimore. We know has a history of producing head coaches elsewhere.
That's their MO. I mean, that's where Kubiak is a very interesting candidate, not just because of the years in Houston, and not just because of his time in Denver, but also his year in Baltimore. I actually was talking with somebody about Kubiak this morning. And I kind of liken his year in Baltimore to a couple of decades ago when Mike Shanahan went to San Francisco for three seasons and served as offensive coordinator. Almost all of his pro experience at that point had come in Denver, aside from a brief stint as Raiders head coach that didn't end very well, didn't last very long. But it was the 3 years in San Francisco which really helped shape a lot of his thinking that he brought when he returned to Denver, and of course had a very successful, for the most part, 14-year run as head coach. So Kubiak, goes to Baltimore, which has a different culture than the Broncos and the 49ers they worked with a long time ago, and also the Texans, where he was head coach for seven plus seasons. And I wonder if he is a candidate for the job, how his thoughts. And how his philosophy will have evolved from being exposed to an environment that is probably the closest thing to a cradle of coaches in recent NFL history as we have, because you just look at the guys that have come through that staff. Jack Del Rio, who just left the Broncos for the Raiders, he worked in Baltimore many years ago. Mike Smith was coaching Atlanta. He was in Baltimore. Rex Ryan, now in Buffalo, he was in Baltimore. They just, Jim Caldwell was the Colts offensive coordinator and then moved on, had a very successful season in Detroit. There's something about the culture of that organization in which guys seem to learn and grow as coaches and then apply that and generally have quite a bit of success applying those principles.
Did you mention Chuck Pagano?
Didn't, no. There you go. That's the thing. There are so many of them. You look around the league and, you see – you always want to say, okay, what coaching trees are productive?
Yeah.
The Belichick coaching tree isn't great, hasn't really worked out. Mm-hmm. But to me, with the Baltimore, it's the organizational coaching tree because, some of these guys worked under Brian Billick, some of these guys worked under John Harbaugh, but they had some continuity on the staff going from one to the other and continuity in the organization with Ozzie Newsome running things so brilliantly in the front office that it's – I think it makes those guys better coaches, and that's why I think Kubiak of potential candidates is so intriguing because I don't, between being a head coach in Houston and working in Baltimore, if he does come back here, he's not the same guy that he was when he worked here.
And I would add with Kubiak that there was sort of a feeling when he, his time in Houston ran down, that his scheme, the scheme that the Broncos had used, for those Super Bowl runs, that it wasn't up to date. It wasn't
lasting. That to Justin Forsett.
Exactly. It wasn't lasting in today's NFL, especially the passing game portion of it, that the passing game couldn't evolve to meet today. But, Joe Flacco had an infinitely better season than he did the year before. Justin Forsett, as you mentioned, and We know that the Broncos here, the linemen can run that zone scheme, and, mm-hmm. and C.J. Anderson can really run behind it because he's so short he can hide and really explode with those cutbacks.
I think he can run in any scheme, C.J.
Not to say that he couldn't, but he does fit it well.
That, you know, where you get the guy's zone blocking, you tell the running back one cut and go. I think C.J. did very well, and I think – in the right kind of scheme going forward, he could do even better. But, you know, it's still an open search. I mean, you know, John Fox has said Adam Gase internally is...
John Elway.
You know what? See, this is why when people made fun of John Elway, when he had his opening statement on Tuesday, when he said, I'd like to thank John Elway. And he got grief. They put on Deadspin. They put on Big Lead, all sorts of stuff. Who among us hasn't had malaprops every now and then when we got a microphone in front of us? So, yes. Yeah, there's my malaprop.
And continuing with this talk about head coaches, Del Rio's, of course, comes within the division, moving to Oakland, coaching the Raiders. What do you think of this fit?
It's a potentially very good fit. And, you know, the Raiders have struggled for a long time. They just wrapped up their 12th consecutive non-winning season. But... you know, Del Rio is a Northern California guy. His parents are still Raiders season ticket holders. He's got a brother who works security at the Coliseum. He, I think, will embrace that environment. And he's going to a team that has struggled, but they've got some parts.
Well, you talk about Khalil Mack.
Khalil Mack, you know, I think Khalil Mack's going to have a phenomenal season playing under Jack Del Rio. And whoever his defensive coordinator is, there's been some talk that Mike Smith, who was a defensive coordinator in Jacksonville, is going to end up on that staff. That would be a good get if that works out. And Derek Carr, you know, certainly he struggled in the season finale, but showed a lot of progress. And I think you're going to give him some more targets. And this is a team that's got over $50 million under the salary cap going into the off season. They're going to spend. They're going to be players. I think there's a chance that they can provide a pretty robust talent injection to that roster, and it'll be interesting to see what Del Rio does with it. The other thing to consider as well is all the Broncos coaches, of course, they're still under contract, but they have permission to interview for other jobs. So how many Broncos staffers will he take? And the same thing could come into play with John Fox interviewing with Chicago, and if he gets that job, will he take some staffers as well? So I think it could be a ripple effect, because it might leave the Broncos with a pretty well overhauled staff going into 2015.
And you talk about coaching trees. I mean, now two of the head coaches in the AFC West, that is not the Broncos, have come from the Broncos.
Mm-hmm.
And one is replacing
another one,
former Bronco.
Exactly.
And Dennis
Allen. It's Chiefs are kind of the outlier, but
hey. You would think that would kind of lead to some rivalry. Maybe coming back between the Raiders if they kind of get a little bit better.
And let's face it, when they have the aforementioned $50 million plus under the cap, and the Broncos have 12 unrestricted free agents.
And yeah, several of those Del Rio is very familiar with.
Yes, you don't have to be a math major to be able to connect, you know, to put two and two together and connect the dots. It would not surprise me, and if there's at least a couple of Broncos that end up on the Raiders once free agency is done. And Dennis Allen did something similar. He had a Jason Hunter that he took they took with him from Denver that he brought in eventually. So I mean, you go with what you know. You go with guys that you're comfortable with, and guys that you can win with. So it's going to add a lot of spice to a rivalry that probably has not been all that it could be in the last few years. But I think it's going to hit another level in the next couple of years with Del Rio out there. So those games are going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, and as far as bringing in a guy you're familiar with, Del Rio may not be familiar with Khalil Mack yet, but Mack plays very similar style to Von Miller, similar role, and that was installed by Dennis Allen. Mm-hmm. You know, so certainly right there he already has a comfortable chess piece that he can move around. And I think it would be easy to look at his record in Jacksonville. He was 67-70, I think.
But look what's happened to them since then. And I think that may have been part of how he sold himself. You know, when he went through the interview process is that he did a lot with, I think, a roster that I think was talent deficient in a lot of spots to keep them competitive. And without him, the whole thing just completely fell apart, and they're still kind of, and they're still in the wilderness. And I think
it's a place that wasn't desirable to go to.
Right,
so he couldn't get a lot of.
I think
players.
Del Rio would have kept them competitive if he stayed in Jacksonville. Very, you know, similar to John Fox in that, you know, maybe it didn't work out pushing a very good team over the top, but when it comes to taking a team with a shaky roster with a lot of holes and not much depth and getting the most out of them. Fox did that, and I think Del Rio did that in Jacksonville quite a bit, and I expect the same thing from him in Oakland.
Sure. And it's clear that both sides wanted that to happen. Mm-hmm. Del Rio wanted to be in Oakland, and Oakland wanted him back.
But the Raiders are going to pick high. They're going to pick high in every round. So, you know, they had a good draft last year, another good draft this year. And the thing is with them, they think they have the quarterback. I mean, the jury will still be out on Derek Carr, I think, for a while, but he made progress. You've got the linchpin on defense. Now, you know, you'd like to shore up pass protection a bit, but you're starting to look for now complementary parts rather than the hardest guys to find. That's why I think they're in good shape.
Moving forward to discussing teams that have done a little bit better this past season, let's look at the championship games that are coming up on this weekend. You have Green Bay, Seattle, and you have obviously the Patriots and the Colts in another regular season rematch. Do you think that'll be more like what we saw in that regular season game with the Patriots stomping the Colts?
I think certainly they're going to try to run the football in the same way that they ran it in Indianapolis.
That has been so far not part of their game.
But that's the Patriots. I mean, the Patriots, you know, and Josh McDaniels and Bill Belichick, they're chameleons in their game plan. They're going to, you know, react to what the opponent gives them. And I think although I was impressed by the Colts on Sunday, I don't like their chances in this game because I think if they overplay the run, all you're going to do is set Gronkowski free and it's pick your poison. I don't know if the Colts will be able to match what the Patriots can do to keep them off balance. I think this might be just a little bit too much for them to chew.
And you look, I mean, one of the keys for me for the Ravens last week was that they were able to run the ball, and they were. They did pretty well, and they still lost the game, but they were very close. But the Colts don't even have that running attack.
No, the Broncos shut it down pretty well for the most part until they got some runs on that 8-minute drive. But it's not an explosive running attack. The Colts will use the short dump offs to Daniel Heron as running plays in effect. So will that be enough to keep the Patriots off balance? Will that, you know, I think what you want to do a little bit, I think you're going to want to get the screen game going. Not only to Heron, but also, you know, maybe even get T.Y. Hilton set up on some bubble screens as well.
At the same time, the Patriots defense has some real speed there at linebacker with Jamie Collins, which
he's tremendous.
He might be one of the best at chasing down, you know, running backs on short passes.
Down running receivers going downfield on routes.
To me, that part of the Colts passing attack, I don't know if I'm that confident in that part. The other part that I would worry about if I'm the Colts on offense, we saw it when the Broncos went to Foxborough, but the Patriots love right now to use Collins and Hightower in the A-gaps with Akeem Ayers and Chandler Jones or Rob Ninkovich, whoever they have on the outside, and they'll bring six up, and you don't know which four are coming. Two will drop back, and it's the effect of a blitz. Well, I think that sort of deception could give the Colts offensive line some real trouble, especially with the injuries they've had up front. They have Khalid Holmes at center, who's been, he's young and he's been iffy. So I see that as being a lot more trouble than, say, the Broncos gave the Colts last week.
There's plenty that was frustrating about that game, but one thing that will rankle the Broncos players for a while is how they didn't generate pressure against an offensive line that at this point is pretty much duct tape and bailing wire because they've had so many adjustments and so many injuries.
It's back to what it was during Luck's first 2 years.
Yep.
After all the work they did to build it back up, it's back to that limited line that it was. And going back to your point about the Patriots being willing to sort of change their game plan to whatever is necessary, I'm really curious to see what they do on offense because, obviously, they put on film all of the six offensive linemen and the power running game in Indianapolis earlier in the season. Are they so confident that that will work again that they, you know, build their attack around that again? Or do they go with something completely different just to keep the Colts off balance, which we know they like to do to a lot of teams?
See, I think they're going to take a look at how the Colts are lined up, and if they see them going run heavy, then I think you're going to see Tom Brady just audible and take advantage
sure.
of that. That's the advantage of having a veteran like that who and with veteran pieces around him, you know, like Gronkowski, like Julian Edelman, and all you have to do is make a couple of hand signals and you've completely changed the emphasis of the offense, and then you're forcing the Colts to adjust again. That's why I think the Patriots have a pretty significant advantage in this game, because I think that if the Colts overreact to what happened when they met in November, they're just going to make a quick adjustment and they're going to keep right on going.
The one thing I would counter with that, I guess, would be that if the Patriots bring out the six offensive linemen, I don't think they're quite as versatile to create that difficult to defend passing attack. They have the other pieces out there, but if that six lineman is out there, it limits what they can do with personnel a little bit as far as switching quickly to a pass. And we know that the Colts have some really talented corners. Vontae Davis had an absolutely tremendous game last week. I think it would be interesting to see what happens, whether or not the Patriots go with that six offensive lineman frequently.
You know, Tom Brady, people question his arm earlier in the season, but he can make those passes. And, you know, even if
well, especially down the seam. I mean, if you have a question about Brady, it's deep and outside. But so much of what Gronk is doing is down the seam and on inside, and Brady's just fine on those routes. And that's and Gronkowski, you know, he needs no separation to make a play. I mean, just go back and look at some of the catches that he made when the Broncos played him. You know, T.J. Ward draped all over him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, okay. It's
sure.
You know, he's special. And you look back at the last 3 years of the Patriots, and you know, there's the offense with Gronk and the offense without Gronk, and the offense with Gronk is extremely difficult to stop.
Then in the earlier game, we have Green Bay facing the Seahawks. You know, Green Bay kind of escaped one a close game with Dez Bryant nearly making a touchdown grab, and the Packers escape. And then Seattle beat the Panthers pretty handily. Not the biggest challenge there with the Panthers kind of overachieved for what they had. Seattle's defense was phenomenal, especially in the passing game, as you'd expect with a Byron Bell left tackle. But
another offensive line that was put together with spare parts, and against that pass, against that front four, it was pretty rough night.
You know, but Green Bay has obviously got a much, much better offensive line. Seattle's defense facing Aaron Rodgers, who, you know, give him more time. He says, what did he say?
He said he thinks he has 120 minutes of football left in him this year. So if either of
these I hope they don't go to overtime, then,
say,
for his sake.
If either game goes to overtime, we're in real trouble.
But you wonder, you know, facing that secondary, going to be a little bit more trouble than Dallas would give them.
And certainly the lack of mobility that Rodgers will have with the calf, that's going to play in as well, because, you know, we saw when on the attempts where he did try to move, you know, he had the touchdown, but boy, mm-hmm. it was painful to watch for someone who we've seen over the years be, you know, not exactly a runner, but definitely nimble. It certainly changes part of their game, and of course, Seattle's so tough in the secondary, so aggressive in the secondary. Is Rodgers going to be able to buy himself enough time for the enough time with that pass rush for his receivers to get open downfield? It's a tough matchup, and you can go back and look a little bit at the game in week one. Both teams are quite a bit different than they were back then, but at the same time, because Rodgers has lost some of his mobility, I think in some ways Green Bay is kind of at step one, at where they were at the start of the season when their offensive line was struggling.
And I think it's disappointing if you're a football fan in general. You want to see these two teams as whole as possible. You want to see the full version of Rodgers and see what happens on that side of the ball, because it's one of the best matchups you could envision. I wonder if it creates more opportunities for Seattle to blitz, knowing that Rodgers has to be sort of in place. It's easy to design a blitz when you know where the quarterback's going to be. They don't blitz a whole lot, but they may bring it from certain positions in this game. They may disguise a little bit and only bring four, but out of, you know, multifaceted fronts. I think the biggest difference that I'd like to see, or that I'm curious to watch, would be the offensive line is healthy again. They're playing well. How they get the running game going against the Seahawks. We know the Seahawks have a great run defense, but the Packers, and they've talked about this a little bit, they've last year down the stretch when Rodgers was hurt, they were forced to run constantly in situations where it wasn't beneficial to them to run, and they really are confident in their abilities to do that against difficult fronts. So I think that becomes a huge part of this game if they can get Eddie Lacy going, pick up some quality yardage on the ground, and you know, get some extra movement off of play action against those zones. That, to me, will be the key on that side of the ball.
Well, I mean, the Panthers, it wasn't like they weren't able to get nothing on Seattle's running defense. They did do all right. I think they had, it looks like they had 130 yards. They did fine.
Sure. And it's a different attack. It's an option-based attack.
Zone read. Right. Yeah. I don't think you're seeing Green Bay doing a lot of zone sure. read but type I, stuff. Like, but they, I do think you can do a little bit.
Seattle.
You can.
And you can run at them without, you don't have to go side to side. And the Packers, I don't know. I think with the guards that they have, with Josh sitting in there and they have some talent on the offensive line that is – it's a good chemistry group right now. They've been together for a while, good continuity.
And if you get Eddie Lacy out of the backfield, you know, being that size and having that size, that power, he's got a chance to be able to break through a tackle at the second level and turn a three-yard run into an eight- or ten-yard run. That – the kind of play that would really, I think, force Seattle to be less aggressive defensively and not tee off on Aaron Rodgers so much and to create some openings for their targets downfield. So, I mean, there's a path for the Packers to win this game, certainly. I mean, the other thing we'll talk about is, you know, Green Bay's defense, which, you know, kind of underrated part of their equation, but has only given up 24 or more points once in their last nine games, playing pretty good ball. You know, Julius Peppers has had a little bit of a revival moving outside linebacker in that 3-4 scheme. And I just remember when he was back in Carolina, you know, it's kind of one of his dreams was he always wanted to be a 3-4 outside backer. Carolina ran 4-3.
290 pounds.
Yeah, he always wanted to try that. I was actually sure. Surprised when in 2010 in free agency he went to Chicago because they were a 4-3 team. But right. Now he's there are some parts of Pep that have been unleashed that haven't seen from him in about a decade. So
and he gets to play
to
in other positions too. He'll play over the guard. He'll play, you know, the traditional 4-3 end alignment.
It's amazing how athletic he is and how much he can do in year 13.
Well, he's a basketball player.
Right, yeah. But I mean,
he was a freak.
Yeah, but I mean that he's maintained so much of that athleticism after, you know, being in the trenches for so long in this league. I mean, really, you know, I think you said, I mean, he is a physical freak because he's been able to maintain so much of that despite his age.
And last week people talked about the Dez Bryant catch as the turning point in that game, but the key play in that game was Pepper's strip of DeMarco Murray and the recovery for the Packers. And frankly, I think that play actually points out why this may be difficult for Green Bay's defense. DeMarco Murray might have been gone for a touchdown on that play if Peppers didn't get him. It actually reminded me a lot of the play from 2011 against the Bears for the Tebow-led Broncos where Marion Barber was almost gone in overtime to run away, and at the last second Wesley Woodyard stripped the ball and sort of saved the game. I think that could have been a really long run if Peppers doesn't get him. And the Packers' defense through the first half of the season was terrible. It was in really rough shape. They had some injuries at linebacker. They moved Clay Matthews inside a little bit, and that's helped. But can they sustain that for a whole game against Marshawn Lynch and this Seattle running game? I don't know.
We'll see. But especially Russell Wilson has that habit on third down of just ripping your heart out time and again. We saw that back in week three. And that's, you know, That's the one thing that I'm not sure Green Bay can cope with is when Wilson does take off on third and eight and get 10 or 12 yards. Can they, if they can prevent, find a way to prevent those runs, they have a chance. But I don't think they have the types of linebackers that can maintain their responsibilities in coverage while also serving as a spy. Because you're not going to want Julius Peppers to spy. You're going to want him to attack.
But you may have Clay Matthews spying at times. You may mix it up. You may have Ha-Ha Clinton Dix or, you know, a safety spy at times.
I would have loved Clay Matthews spying like 3 or 4 years ago. I'm not sure about him handling all that on Sunday.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
The focus is on Russell Wilson's legs on those third downs that you were talking about. But his arm was huge for them on third down last week. I mean, that touchdown pass to Jermaine Kearse, that just ripped their hearts out.
Can you imagine what he'd be with one elite wide receiver?
Scary.
Holy cow. Yeah.
That's wasn't Percy Harvin supposed to be an elite wide receiver?
Well, he was an elite speed guy, player. I'm not sure we could.
Sure. He wasn't a route technician.
No. It really wasn't any kind of technician. Yeah. Technician.
Well, I guess I'm curious about Russell Wilson. We almost never see him really just drop back, read a defense, and throw. And he doesn't have to. He's not being asked to do that. So that's, you know, that I'm not going to fault him for that. But I'm curious how he would do if he had, two receivers, maybe like the ones that are in Denver right now or something like that, where they really, you know, they scheme it and they have all sorts of different routes that he needs to read and adapt to the defense and just throw.
Well, that's what's going to be interesting about the evolution of the Seahawks, because Russell Wilson is going to get a massive contract almost certainly for them. Probably, I would expect, in the $23 million, $24 million a year range. So that is going to change the composition of this team long term. I mean, I don't think it's going to be a team that's going to be able to be as reliant upon the defense as it is right now. And how will it evolve? And although clearly Wilson is an elite quarterback, but I think he's going to need an elite target to develop. And that's where Kearse has shown some flashes, but they have very high hopes for a guy that a lot of people around here know. That's Paul Richardson from the University of Colorado, who showed some flashes, kind of. Reminds me a little bit of a guy that we saw on Sunday from Indianapolis, Dante Moncrief. There were some brilliant moments from him, especially in the second half of the year, and they're going to count on more from him next year. Whether he becomes elite, too early to say. I'm a little concerned about whether his body type can hold up to the punishment in the NFL, but certainly he has a lot of other tools.
Right, and we won't see him the rest of this year because he tore his ACL against the Panthers, but I'm not sure that affects the Seahawks attack too much now.
We'll see how those games go this weekend on Sunday. Next week, we'll be at the Pro Bowl.
Game's going to be in Glendale. I think we're going to be somewhere in Phoenix. I'll be in Mobile at the Senior Bowl before that, where a lot of the Broncos personnel department will be watching 100 potential draft picks go through their routes and interviewing quite a few of them. It's kind of the beginning of the pre-draft process. I mean, you have some other all-star games like the Shrine Game going on this week, but it's at the Senior Bowl where you can really start having formal interviews with guys. Like, you watch them in practice, and then they have formal interviews at night, and so you really kind of start your preparation beyond what you've seen on film and beyond what you've gotten from your scouts. This is where John Elway and Matt Russell are really going to start to get to know the guys that they're going to draft. So if the Broncos don't have a coach by then, it's going to be a very, very busy week for John Elway, basically doing double duty, because he's going to have to do work down there as well, because the draft is going to be on us before we know it.
So that'll mean I don't think we'll have a podcast next week, sadly. I don't think we'll have room to bring all our equipment on the plane.
Unless you can record it. Well, there is a way. If we can do like a phone recording, or I could send you a segment. An MP3 from the Senior Bowl, and you could
perhaps Lauren and I will put Skype together here.
You know what? It would actually be a good time for an AFC West roundup, because I presume the Raiders will put together some more of their staff by then. Can talk more about that, and we'll see what the Chiefs and Chargers are kind of laying in the weeds a little bit, but kind of revisit them. I mean, they're both 9-7 this year. I think we can have a podcast next week.
We'll see what we can do. Sure.
We don't want to deprive our listeners. I'm sure they look forward to that every week.
There are some things that we do year round. I mean, the season ended, but I'm doing a mailbag on Friday.
We don't want to deprive our advertisers. Oh wait, never mind. We don't have any of those.
We're getting there. We're getting the sales staff is doing work.
I'll leave that to them. I think I'll keep my hands out of that. Anyway, thanks for tuning in this week. Enjoy the off season. We'll come back to you either in a week or two.